accession number 12502, reel 6.
Field Marshal Lord Bramall, reel 6. I was asking if you saw anything of the Japanese armed forces or their remnants.
No, there must have been homecoming Japanese who went into rehabilitation centres and so on, and we may have had some responsibility regarding some of those, but the whole attitude had changed. I mean, they were just there to do what we wanted. They gave absolutely no trouble.
How did you get on with the Americans?
Well, we didn't see very much of them, except that I remember once going up and seeing MacArthur. Their headquarters was in Tokyo, of course, and we had a distinctive area of Japan which came under the British Commonwealth Occupation Force, which was commanded by an Australian general. And so they didn't really interfere at all with us. But they were responsible for the administration. And in fact, MacArthur handled the whole situation brilliantly. There's no doubt about that.
How long did you spend out in Japan then before?
Nearly a year. And by that time, I'd been overseas for quite a time, and I came back and I took up a job as on the staff of the Military Operations Directorate in England, dealing with the Middle East. And I did that for about 18 months, and I did a course at the School of Infantry Company Commanders, of course, School of Infantry Warminster. I did fairly well on the course, and after a time out with my 1st Battalion in Bushfield, Hampshire, I went back as an instructor at the School of Infantry.
When you were posted to the War Office, to the Military Operations Directorate, what were your duties there? What were you actually doing?
Well, it was one of the most important directorates, of course, Director of Military Operations in the War Office. And my chief job was briefing indirectly the Chief of Staff and the Vice Chief of Staff at all the various Chiefs of Staff meetings on Middle East matters. And there were several captains like myself, because at the end of the war, though I'd been a major, I had to come down to captain because I was only a war substantive captain. And there were several captains and there were some majors, and my G1 was a chap who is now Lord Charteris, who became the Queen's private secretary. And we prepared briefs for the Director of Military Operations to put to the Chief of the General Staff, Imperial General Staff, who was Field Marshal Montgomery at the time. And, of course, there was a lot happening in the Middle East, tremendous lot. Palestine, the mandate in Palestine, treaties in Libya, problems in East Africa, Iraq, the Gulf. This was a very busy area even then. So there was a lot of work to do. But it was mostly sending out instructions to commanders, drafting orders, putting up briefs, and flagging up documents so that the Chief of Staff would go into the meeting with all the necessary information. We always used to say it, if we got a brief through untouched, bearing in mind the number of layers it had to go through before it went into the great man's hand, it was a subject of such indescribable boredom that nobody wanted to make their own imprint in it. Otherwise, of course, all the way up, somebody put in a little bit of their own thing. But it was a fascinating early training and my first connection with the Chiefs of Staff system.
Roughly how many people were there in this particular... Was it a branch or a section that you were in?
Yes, MO, military operation. MO, as it was always generally known, still is generally known, was divided into four, MO 1, 2, 3 and 4, and they dealt with different bits of the world.
So it's a geographical...
As they do now, but the numbers have all changed. MO4 was the Middle East. I think in those days MO2 was the Far East. MO3 was Europe. And MO1 was the coordinating branch. And the director of military operations was a chap called General Dudley Ward, who died only about a couple of weeks ago.
And how many officers were there in MO4 then?
MO4, there was a grade 1 staff officer, 3 grade 2 staff officers, and about 6 grade 3 staff officers.
Was the grade 1 a colonel?
Lieutenant colonel.
Lieutenant colonel.
And he went straight up to the director of military operations or the deputy director of military operations.
Was the work within the directorate of MO4 subdivided by countries, or did all of you handle the whole area?
No, we were subdivided. Some of us dealt with Palestine and the central part of the Middle East. Some dealt with, and I think Libya too, I'm not sure. Some dealt with East Africa, and others with Iraq and Iran. And there were 3 sections, more or less coinciding. Oh, we also had Greece in there. Greece came under us as well.
The Greek Civil War was going on.
Yes, that was right. So that was it. Because there was no NATO then, you see. So Greece was part of the Middle East.
Did you get a good general overall impression of what was going on in Palestine as a result of being in the directorate? Could you keep a sort of overview?
Oh, absolutely. And we had, particularly the G1, used to get delegations coming in from the Arab Legion, Irgun Zaylumi, all these people lobbying for position. But of course, as you know, eventually the foreign secretary said, this is impossible, this is a non-win situation. Britain abandoned the mandate, and it was left for the Jews and Arabs to fight it out.
Did you have direct lateral contact with the Foreign Office as a result of being in this position?
Yes, we did. We had liaison with the Foreign Office, various sections dealing with this. It was very much a military political job, and this was my first experience of that, of course.
What impression did you get of the Foreign Office officials you were dealing with?
Well, very, very erudite, cleverer than any of us in many ways. Yes, I think on the whole, some very high calibre chaps.
Was the liaison between the two departments smooth? Were there ever any sources of friction as a result of having different priorities?
Well, it's very difficult to answer that question, of course, without knowing specific instances. But I suppose there must have been variations in things. But on the whole, I seem to think we got on pretty well together. But there may have obviously been slight variations. I mean, obviously, for instance, the general officer commanding troops in Palestine was, very concerned about the protection of his own troops out there and things like that. And having a clear instruction of what he was supposed to do. And I think probably the Foreign Office were feeling their way a little bit more. But I'm not conscious that there was a real clash at that particular time. It was a very, very difficult situation. I mean, nobody quite knew what to do because British foreign policy got itself into an appalling muddle over the years, not knowing really who it was backing and hoping to be all things to all men. I mean, they backed the Arabs very strongly after the Arab revolt. And then they, of course, time of the Balfour Declaration, backed the Israelis, or the Jews, and I mean nobody really knew what they wanted to happen, because who is right in Palestine depends on which bit of history you're looking at that particular time, and the answer is that they're all right in some senses. And if you do one thing in support of the Jews, you're being grossly unfair to the Arabs, and if you do one thing in support of the Arabs, you're being very unfair to the Jews. And so, you know, it is unfortunately a situation which is extremely difficult to resolve.
Do you think, based upon the things you saw at the time, that a military solution to the disorder in Palestine was a possibility.
No, I don't think it was. I really don't think it was. I mean, not without the... Well, I mean, you say the injection of enormous numbers of troops, but you can't. You can't keep the... I mean, I suppose you could have... If you had put yourself 100% on behind the Jews, say, you put yourself 100% behind the Jews, you could have helped them carve out a Palestine of the sort of size that they've got now and which is still being debated. But if you were going to try and keep the peace between them and see that neither side got untoward advantage, then of course, there was really nothing you could do.
Did you have any knowledge of our relations with the French in that area? Because at the time, we were helping to ease the French out of Syria and Lebanon, and I think that we had a considerable military presence in Syria up to the point where the French garrisons were persuaded to leave and the French were persuaded to give up their attempt to maintain some sort of protector status.
I'm sure this came into it, but I would be confusing you if it's not something that stuck in my mind all those years ago.
What about the situation in Egypt? Because
that is something again that came. No, this was of course the business of producing the Anglo-Egyptian Treaty and trying to find a balance between the progressive, complete independence of Egypt. And after all, up to that time, it was really a sort of British protectorate. And we had the commander of the Egyptian army and so on, trying to give them complete independence, and at the same time holding on to what we at the time, I think, overestimated it, the absolute essential of imperial communications, a presence on the canal. And it was this trying to get these two balances, which was never very satisfactory, and of course eventually blew up completely when Nasser, Naguib, and then Nasser came to power, and they weren't prepared to have the British sitting in large quantities on Egyptian soil. And of course it then all blew up with the Aswan Dam and the nationalisation of the canal on the disastrous Suez operation, but the whole of this at that time was the political side, and this is where I suppose there was some difference of opinion, political side saying, look, we must give Egypt more independence and really let them run their own affairs. It's all old hat, this thing. And the military saying, the fundamental part of our strategy is the retention of the British presence in the Suez Canal. No one else can run the canal. We need that presence to ensure, remember it was the days before long-range aircraft and things like that, all our communications go through the Middle East. The whole basis of our strategy is sitting on the canal. Well, looking back now, that seems to be a very great overstating of the case, but then it was the number one pillar of our strategy. It was trying to reconcile these two things that our policy was directed at.
I seem to remember that there were disorders in Egypt at the time, not in the sense of a real military threat, but there were...
Oh, there were certainly disorders, because later on in my service, after passing the staff college, you see, I went to, after the period we're talking about, I did this course at the School of Infantry. I then did 2 years as an instructor at the School of Infantry on the tactics side. I then went back to my battalion for a short time, and I then went to the staff college, and on being posted from the staff college, and we're now talking about 1953-54, I was sent to the G2 operations to the 3rd British Division, which was garrisoning the canal. And we had quite a lot of internal security problem, because just before I'd arrived, if you remember, British troops under General Erskine had attacked the Egyptian police station at Ismailia, and there was quite a battle. And we were under siege, really. from low-level terrorism on the canal for those 2 years. I mean, we went about with guns in our shopping baskets and so on.
Was this threat foreseen when you were in the MO4 directorate? Was it conceived as a possibility that the Egyptians might start employing terrorist activity or...
No, but I mean, I think it was all part and parcel of the pressure to try to get some sort of independence. And it was this impossible equation. I mean, should I, of a young officer, have said, I think you're greatly overestimating this canal zone, we don't need to be there. I mean, this is what was said 6 years later, whatever it was, time of Suez. After Suez, people said, oh, there's no need to be there. But they hadn't said that before, and it really wasn't for me as a grade 3 staff officer. I mean, I don't know whether I thought we were overstating it or not, but it was an absolute pillar of our strategy. And it wasn't just sort of a few bumped-up staff officers that were saying it. I mean, it was all the Montes and the Templars and the Slims, and everybody was saying it, you know, fundamental.
And the politicians,
but fashions do change. Well, politicians bought it.
Now, the other things which were really bubbling up at the time, as I remember it, is the question of the status of the Sudan. Do you remember having anything to do with that?
Mm, it was quite so. Well, what, remind me of what was...
Well, the Egyptians, we were contemplating withdrawing from the Sudan, giving the Sudan independence. The Egyptians, who'd shared the condominium with us, in theory, had a claim to the Sudan and wanted to annex it. And in the end, we conducted a plebiscite, and the Sudanese voted very strongly against becoming part of Egypt, but Egyptians were exerting a lot of intimidatory pressure.
No, I remember this going on, but I can't quite remember the... And it was all part and parcel of our branch, but I can't quite remember the particular input at any one time. But I do remember things happening. Same was happening in Libya, too, of course, with an Anglo-Libyan treaty. This was long before the days of Gaddafi, of course. It was when the Senussi was King Idris of Libya. But so there was a very great deal happening in the military political field, in all that area, and it was fascinating being part of that branch.
Because Libya, as I remember, was somewhat turbulent because it had been an Italian possession.
That's absolutely right.
From 1912 onwards. Mm. And
there were British forces in Libya.
There were British forces in Libya, but the Soviet Union made a claim to occupation of Libya.
I think it came a little later, probably than that time, a little later than 1946. I think, when we were there. Fascinating, we occupied a round office immediately below the Chief of the General Staff, Chief of the Imperial General Staff. And, of course, I saw the chiefs in action. Monty, who was one of our great field commanders, but was a disastrous Chief of Staff.
Why was that, do you think?
Well, he couldn't understand that Whitehall wasn't just just like a battlefield where he was the army commander, and he said, do this, and everybody did it. He didn't realise that in Whitehall it was much more complicated than that. You had the political scene, you had the financial scene, you had to coordinate with other departments. He couldn't understand that at all. I mean, he just said, this is the solution, we'll do this. He didn't realise that being a chief of staff, your success depends on you being able to convince and massage and be tactful and get things through. And he didn't attempt to do that. And he also, of course, didn't get on with the other two chiefs at all. One of them was Tedder, who he absolutely loathed, and Tedder loathed him, dating back from the days that Tedder tried to get him sacked in Normandy, if you remember. And the other chap, Cunningham, not the famous A.B. Cunningham, but John Cunningham, Monty thought was too clever by half, and he didn't like Monty either, and Monty irritated them by going round the world and acting as if he was their boss and saying, I've decided this, you know, this is what I suggest we do. And of course they didn't like that. He wasn't even chairman of the chiefs of staff. Tedder was.
I've heard also that he didn't get on very well with Attlee.
I don't think he got on too badly with Attlee, although Attlee got very angry with him when he went and hogged the limelight and started initiatives which were more appropriate for politicians and military, and went over to America and saw all the top people and said, we must do this, when he'd had no authority from the government to do it. So in that way, Attlee disapproved of him. But he did get on very well with Shinwell, of course. He couldn't stick Alexander, and I'm talking now about the politician Alexander.
A.V. Alexander.
He didn't like him. But he got on very well with Shinwell, both as army minister and minister of defence.
Thinking about it in general terms, some theorists maintain that to be a commander in the field takes one sort of mentality, and to be a staff officer, particularly at the highest level, takes a different mentality. Do you think that is the case?
I think it's very often that you can't combine it in one person. But let's take two people who did manage to combine it. One with Alan Brooke, who was an incomparable Whitehall warrior, and was also, although he was not perhaps tested as much as all that, a very decent field commander as well, and would have liked to have had the overall command in Normandy, but was a corps commander, and was a good commander. And the other was Bill Slim, who was an incomparable field commander, nobody doubted that at all, and made a very good shot of being a good chief of staff in Whitehall.
But they were rare birds, weren't they?
Well, I think they were rare birds. I mean, I don't think it's always easy to combine the two, but there have been people who could do both. But usually people have a métier, and Monty's métier was field command, there's no doubt about it.
What about the soldier Alexander, Field Marshal Alexander?
He's a much more mysterious character. It's very difficult to put your finger on why he was a great soldier. I mean, I think his achievements, directly or indirectly, must indicate that he was a great soldier. He had enormous courage, enormous charm, wonderful sort of flair of getting on with people. People suspected that he hadn't got a tremendous lot upstairs, and he was certainly a disastrous Minister of Defence, which of course he should never have taken on because he was totally unsuited to it. But as a supreme commander, he was marvellous. And you'll know that amusing story of how Monty was asked down by the headmaster of Winchester, who'd been once one of his staff officers in the war, to inspect the corps. And the first boy he went up to, he said in typical Monty fashion, "Who was the greatest general in the last war?" And the boy, without a murmur, said, "General Alexander, sir." In which case, on which Monty, quite unabashed, said, "Quite right, quite right. He always did everything I told him." And Alex's great strength was really to give Monty his head in the desert and to act as the most charming, debonair, courageous man who let people get on with it. And he did have, towards the end, a very fine chief of staff in General, later Field Marshal, Lord Hardinge.
Perhaps one might say that something that he did share with Slim, Mrs. Alexander, was the ability to operate on reasonable terms with allies.
Alex did.
Alex.
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, that would be none of his... I mean, Alex was Britain's answer to Eisenhower, wasn't he?
Coalition warfare being the norm.
Coalition warfare. Absolutely. And that is why, of course, Eisenhower and the Americans would much prefer to have had Alex commanding the British troops in Normandy than they would Monty, because they knew he would be a much easier fellow to deal with.
And then, again, Slim had not only the Americans to combine with, but also the Chinese and various other elements.
Well, Stillwell, yes, Stillwell and the Yes, yes. Peripherally, it did, yes. But they were all. Batten dealt with them more than Slim. And Slim was running his own army.
Where did you go to then when you went on from Military Operations 4? Was this when you went off to the School of Infantry?
That's when I went on a course to the School of Infantry.
What did that course teach? Was this company
commander? Company commander's course, and of course I was able to draw on my practical experience in Normandy and Northwest Europe. Now this helped me, no doubt, with the course. And I got a good grading on it, and so was asked to go back as an instructor.
Did this company commander's course teach you anything that you didn't already know?
No, I think we contributed. I think it was good for us to marshal our ideas, but I think we contributed. A lot of us had come from the war as much as we got out of the course. Mm.
And had the techniques and procedures of running a company changed at all by the time you went on the course, or was it still all being done as it had been in 1944-45?
Oh, I think it was very much based on that. I don't think there'd been a great change of technique. And, of course, there hadn't been by then any change of technology. So, I mean, if the technology doesn't change, your techniques can't change. I mean, what changed tactics was greater mechanisation, armoured personnel carriers, greater firepower, nuclear weapons, fire-and-forget weapons. I mean, until the technology was changing, there was no reason, really, to change the tactics which had been so successful in World War II.
Now, what year was that in? Because I'm beginning to get a bit out of phase. This was
that was 48, the course, and 49 and 50, I was at the School of Infantry.
Presumably at that time, the Korean War was
just about starting. That's right. Quite a small part of the British Army was in Korea, of course. But it was on the edge of that. I then went back to my battalion, which was a motor battalion in Tidworth, and I stayed there for nearly a year until I went to the Staff College. Having passed a much more difficult exam than they have nowadays, of course it was 7 papers and 7 subjects that you had to do.
How did you manage to prepare for that?
I did a correspondence course.
During the year at Tidworth?
There were 7 papers in the exam. 7 subjects. And to do the correspondence course, you had to do 7 papers and send them away in 7 subjects. So you had to do 49 papers. My wife, when I was newly married then, got pretty fed up.
And this was within the space of, the space of a year, or did you have longer?
No, I did about a year.
Mm. That's approximately 1 essay per week.
That sort of thing. Very onerous. And I don't know whether they got the papers mixed up. I mean, I got a nomination. I passed, and I got a nomination first time, so I went to the Staff College very young. But having said that, I didn't. Although, having been a staff captain, I might have known a lot, but I'd forgotten it by that time. I passed the military law paper, which I really didn't know what I was doing, flying colours. The tactics A paper, I had I'd anticipated the questions. I was right up to date from the Warminster. I knew exactly what I was going to say and said it and finished the paper in good time and everything. And I scraped through by 2 marks. I can only assume that I'd fallen out with the examiner who disagreed with my views.
Always possible. What did commanding a company involved when you were at Tidworth, what were they actually doing? Were they just doing basic training with conscripts?
No, I wasn't even commanding a company. I mean, I'd been on a company commander's course, but I was second in command to a very, very experienced desert company commander. And I was second command of a motor company, manning his headquarters and acting in when he wasn't there and things like that.
Presumably, though by this time there was a regular training cycle because of the requirement to train
Yes, but we were a motor battalion, getting ready to take our place in an armoured brigade. I mean, the things I'd done in the war, so I mean, they were all the things I knew. But it was getting back to regimental duties. You know, I hadn't been with them since July 45. I'd left the battalion, and I was now back in, 51. So I hadn't been with them for except for this training period in, and I, for a short time I went to the
You were saying you've been on a training period.
Well, after the War Office, I went on the course, and after the course I went to the 1st Battalion, which was a training battalion at Winchester, and then after a time there, I then went back to Warminster on the course, and then I went to the 2nd Battalion. This was now in 1951, and then I went to the Staff College in 52.
When you were with the battalion at Tidworth, by then I'm presuming that the soldiers coming through, many of them were National Service men.
Yes.
Did you notice any change in the type of man you were getting in, or in their attitude and approach to things? Because...
Well, I had... It was fascinating, because I was then running this wing of the training battalion, dealing with potential officers. So we had people in the green jackets and people in the Army Education Corps who were going to come through and be sergeants or officers in the Education Corps.